Welcome to STEM Talk.
STEM Talk.
STEM Talk.
STEM
Talk.
STEM Talk.
STEM
Talk.
STEM
Talk.
STEM Talk.
Welcome to STEM Talk, where we introduce you to fascinating people who passionately inhabit the scientific and technical frontiers of our society. Hi, I'm your host, Don Carnegis, and joining me to introduce today's podcast is the man behind the curtain, Dr. Ken Ford, IHMC's director and chairman of the Double Secret Selection Committee that selects all the guests who appear in STEM Talk.
Hello, Don.
I faked you out. Dr. Keith Barr is the head of the Functional Molecular Biology Laboratory in the Department of Neurobiology, Physiology, and Behavior at the University of California, Davis. He is a renowned scientist in the emerging field of molecular exercise physiology and is leading a team of researchers attempting to develop ways to improve muscle, tendon, and ligament function. Our interview with Keith went more than 2 hours, so we decided to divide our conversation with Keith into two parts.
In part one of our interview, which is episode 62 of STEM Talk, we talked to Keith about his background and the work he did in the lab of John Holsey at Washington University in St. Louis. Dr. Holsey is known as the father of exercise research in the United States.
In today's second part of our interview, we talked to Keith about his most recent research, which is looking at how to determine the best way to train and what types of foods complement training to decrease tendon and ligament injury and accelerate return to play. This work not only has the potential to improve muscle function, but also can improve people's quality of life, especially as we age. But before we get to today's interview with Keith, we have some housekeeping to take care of. First, we really appreciate all of you who have subscribed to STEM Talk, and we are especially appreciative of all the wonderful 5-star reviews that are piling up on iTunes. As usual, the Double Secret Selection Committee has been continually and carefully reviewing the iTunes reviews, with an eye towards selecting the wittiest and most lavishly praise-filled reviews to read on STEM Talk. As always, if you hear your review read on STEM Talk, just contact us at stemtalk@ihmc.us to claim your official STEM Talk t-shirt.
Today, our winning review was posted by someone who goes by the moniker Vanessa in Charlottesville. The review is titled Fabulous Podcast. It reads, "Every time I listen to this podcast, it always stretches my thoughts and inspires me to think deeper and question the norms that the medical field is often stuck in. The wide array of topics that are research-based allows a starting point to begin my own research, possible implementation, and discussions with my doctors. STEM Talk is honest, interesting, and thought-provoking."
Thank you so much, Vanessa in Charlottesville, and thank you to all of our other STEM Talk listeners who have helped STEM Talk become such a great success.
Okay, and now on to today's interview with Dr. Keith Barr.
STEM Talk.
STEM Talk.
STEM Talk.
STEM Talk.
STEM
Talk.
Talk.
STEM Talk.
So for the past 8 years, you've been at the University of California, Davis. What prompted you to return to the U.S. and accept the position at Davis?
To be completely honest, it was a family decision. We've got a daughter who was born in Scotland. And like I said, Scotland was a great opportunity. I have a wife who's from Northern California who desperately missed the sun and the warmth of California. And we had a daughter, which meant that there are not very many places where young girls have the same opportunities as young boys. And Northern California is one of those places. So we decided to come to Davis largely for those reasons, but also because I had a good colleague here in Sue Bodine and a number of other opportunities that were here.
Fantastic. So your functional molecular biology lab conducts research across a range of related topics, and we'll discuss some of those as we go into the interview a little bit more. But broadly speaking, one might characterize the lab's focus to be on musculoskeletal development and adaptation, as well as methods for engineering functional musculoskeletal tissues in vitro. Can you give us a high-level overview of that research before we dive into some of it?
Sure. So what we're really looking at is musculoskeletal function. How do we get the musculoskeletal system to work as well as possible? And how does our diet, nutrition, exercise, and age affect our musculoskeletal function?
And so some of your recent work has shown that we can use specific nutrition and training strategies to optimize injury recovery and prevention. And musculoskeletal injuries are among the most common problems that active people have.
In fact, the high rate of injury in many sports is due to the case that strength, power, and speed are dependent on stiff connective tissues, which results in higher rates of injury to the attached musculature. In fact, athletes often train in a fashion intended to stiffen tendons with the goal of increasing performance. Tendons bind compliant muscle to stiff bone. Now, From an engineering perspective, this looks like a likely point of failure. And as we've discussed, increased tendon stiffness can improve performance, but also can increase injury risk. Essentially, I guess the muscle might become slightly less strong than the tendon is stiff. Your work in this area is just fascinating. And I particularly find the, from an engineering point of view, the regional mechanical properties of tendons super interesting and a clever piece of engineering. I wonder if you might discuss this and the trade-off between performance and health in this case of tendons.
Yeah, perfect. So that's a great overview. So basically, what we want to do if we're trying to perform at our best is we want to have the musculotendinous system to be as stiff as possible. Because if my muscle motor pulls and is pulling on a compliant or a stretchy material, if the tendon is stretchy, what happens is it pulls on the tendon and it's like pulling on an elastic band. There's no resistance there, so your movement happens slower. As I stiffen that elastic band into a rope, now it's going to stretch a little bit, but then it's going to actually pull much earlier. But if I have a really stiff material like a steel, if as soon as I pull on a steel rod, whatever's attached to that is going to move. And so if we're trying to maximize our performance, what we're looking to do is we're trying to maximize what we call the rate of force development. And that's basically how quickly we can develop force. This is one of the key parameters for performance. And so if I stiffen the system, if I stiffen my tendon, I'm going to increase rate of force development. And what that means is that I will be able to produce force faster. I will be more powerful by definition. And so that's what we're trying to do with a lot of training. And so if we're going to do at the moment, it's a perfect example. You have a lot of college football players who are training in a very specific way because they were training that way to perform at their best at the NFL Combine, where basically there's a series of tests that are essentially designed to see how explosive and powerful you are. So if you're trying to maximize explosivity and power, what you're going to do is you're going to train quickly so that your muscle and tendon become stiffer and your performance is going to go up. The problem is that those players are going to be drafted here in a couple of weeks. They're going to go to their first training with their football team. And if the football team isn't really careful about how slowly they bring them into the system, if they throw them out on a practice field and now they have to run or do dynamic movements, what happens is the muscle, as you said, is not as strong as the tendon is stiff. And so instead of what's supposed to happen, which is the muscle pulls and the tendon lengthens a little bit, and that allows us to store some energy in the tendon that allows that energy to be brought back in to propel us forward. Instead of that muscle pulling and stretching the tendon a little bit and the tendon acting as a shock absorber, the muscle pulls on the tendon is stiffer. And so instead of the tendon stretching, what has to happen is the muscle stretches. And if you're stretching a muscle at a very high speed, that is the most damaging type of contraction. It's a heavy plyometric contraction. And you get people who rupture their hamstrings or their Achilles, or you'll see in the first week of training camp after the draft that there's always going to be one person who either ruptures an ACL or a hamstring or does a serious injury, musculoskeletal injury, based on they've been training for power to perform well at the combine. Now they're actually need to go into the field to compete. They need to run. That running requires different use of their muscle and tendon together, and the result is that they're going to potentially get a serious injury.
You have noted that tendon stiffness is dependent on collagen content and the amount of crosslinks with the collagen, and you've actually developed various training modalities as well as nutritional protocols that can increase and decrease tendon stiffness, and I find this all fascinating stuff. But let's start with training, and then we'll move on to nutrition in a minute. But if you could start talking about training methods for this purpose.
Sure. So if we're trying to increase stiffness, what we're doing is we're doing movements as quickly as we can. And that's how we're going to increase performance. We're going to move quickly. And what happens is the viscoelasticity of the tendon, which means the tendon behaves both like a liquid, but also as an elastic solid. What that means is that when we move quickly, the tendon behaves differently than when we move slowly. So if we want to increase stiffness, we do very fast movements. And When we do very fast movements, the collagen within the tendon acts as a sheet. It acts as a unified group of molecules. And the result is that that unified group of molecules, you're not going to break any of these little crosslinks that you have in the collagen, and you're going to increase the expression of the gene that makes new crosslinks. And that's going to add crosslinks. You didn't break any. You've got more crosslinks. More crosslinks means a stiffer tissue, and that stiffer tissue is going to allow you to perform better. If we want to decrease injury rate, what we're going to do is we're going to do the loading more slowly. And when we load a viscoelastic tissue like a tendon slowly, now what happens is the individual collagen molecules can act as individual molecules, and they can slide past each other. They can move independently. And when that happens, what happens is you can imagine that if two things are sliding past each other, if there's any connections between them, those connections between them, those crosslinks, will be broken. And that's what we're doing when we do a slow movement, like when we do a heavy isometric movement, or we do a heavy, slow concentric, or so a shortening contraction, or a lengthening contraction. So many of the people who listen to your podcast probably have had a tendinopathy, and they go into a physical therapist, and the physical therapist has them do slow lengthening contractions. What you're doing when you do those slow movements is that you allow the tendon collagen to act as individual molecules. They slide past each other. They break the connections in between. They break the crosslinks in between. And that decreases the stiffness of the tendon. And so that's very protective, because now the shock absorbing capacity of the tendon is remaining intact. You still increase the expression of the cross-linking enzyme, so you're going to add some back. But because you've broken some of the cross-links, you're actually going to decrease slightly the stiffness of the tendon. And so now what you can do is you can play with that. If you're somebody who gets lots of injuries, is super fast to begin with, now you're going to use more slow movements in your training. If you're somebody who's never had a musculoskeletal injury, you can do all of your movements faster, because that's going to improve your performance. And so really what the tool is that we use to decide how much injury risk we're willing to take is we're looking to see how many slow movements we bring into this. And so what we're doing in our training is we're using slow movements, we're using the slowest movement, isometric contractions, as a way to maximize return to play and minimize injuries in athletes.
Following up on that, how do training methods like blood flow restriction training, which is increasingly popular, how do they affect tendon stiffness? Has anybody looked at that?
So nobody's looked at something like blood flow restriction training with tendon stiffness, but what we know is that if you work to failure, your muscle is going to get a stimulus to grow. If you work to failure, the last repetition that you do is always very, very slow, because you're barely able to lift the weight. That slow component is what is beneficial about strength training for injury prevention. Because blood flow restriction goes to that failure point, it shouldn't have a stiffening effect on the tendon. So, but because it doesn't have a high load, we don't know if whether the stimulus from the load is going to be enough to have as much of an effect as a heavier contraction.
Right. That's a good answer. And a lot of interest these days in that, particularly for in-season sports where the person's got some injuries, kind of beat up, don't want them doing heavy squats or something.
Right. So what we use in that situation is we use isometric contractions. And we've got a case study of a professional basketball player who we've developed a program where basically this individual had a central cord tendinopathy of their patellar tendon, and we're able to completely reverse the central cord patellar tendinopathy using isometric contractions together with the nutritional protocol.
Wow, that's impressive.
Mm-hmm. So moving to nutrition, your lab has done a ton of groundbreaking work on the use of gelatin and a small amount of vitamin C to augment collagen synthesis in tendons, ligaments, cartilage, and bone. Can you talk about this nutritional protocol and its effects, especially when combined with jumping rope?
Okay, so in this situation, what we had done is used our engineered tissues to figure out that it doesn't take much exercise to get the cells within a tendon or ligament to get fully active. Within 5 to 10 minutes, the cells are fully active. And if we keep exercising, they actually just turn off. They stop sensing the exercise. And so what that told us is that a short period of exercise, between 5 and 10 minutes, is enough exercise to maximally activate these cells. And then what we found is that it took about 6 hours before you recovered the ability of those cells to signal again. And the same thing is true in bone. And there's other beautiful research by Burr and a number of different colleagues there that have shown that only a few loads are necessary to maximally activate the cells within a bone. And it takes about this 6 to 8 hours, again, for the bone to become sensitive sensitive to the exercise again. And so what we had come up with was a program where you do 5 to 10 minutes of exercise separated by 6 hours. And when we do that, and we do that over a period of 3 days, we had a paper in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition where we showed that just jumping rope every 6 hours for 6 minutes for 3 days increased collagen synthesis within the bone. It seemed to about double it. And so that was really cool because it just showed that the collagen is responsive to the exercise stimulus. And then what we did is we added to that. And what we added to it is we added a nutritional intervention. And specifically, as you were saying, we looked at gelatin. And the reason we looked at gelatin is because in our engineered ligaments, we found that when we added more proline or when we added more amino acids that are enriched in collagen, the ligaments got stronger. They synthesized more collagen. So what we figured was that if we could find a dietary way of increasing these amino acids, we could increase collagen synthesis. And, you know, you do the simple searches and sure enough, it comes out that if you want proline, it's going to be in gelatin, which is just basically collagen that has been denatured. It's basically from skin and bones. And what you find is that if you look at collagen or hydrolyzed collagen or gelatin, any of these sources, what we found is that when you gave them to individuals, you see an increase in the amino acids that are enriched in collagen. So we saw an increase in glycine and proline and the hydroxylated amino acids, hydroxylysine and hydroxyproline. And those amino acids peaked about an hour after you took the supplement. And so what we did is, in the study, is we had people take gelatin together with, like you said, a little vitamin C. It was 50 milligrams. And what we did is we had them do that an hour before they did 6 minutes of jump rope. And we had them do that 3 times a day for 3 days. And what we found is that adding 15 grams of gelatin was enough to further double the collagen synthesis that we saw when we added the jump rope alone. And so what this suggested was that a decent amount of collagen, in this case gelatin, at 15 grams had a positive effect. When we looked at 5 grams, there wasn't the positive effect of the gelatin. And so what that said to us is that if you get in enough gelatin to increase these amino acids that are enriched in collagen, it gives another stimulus to the cells to increase collagen synthesis. And so this is one of the components that we've been using to really try and understand how we can regulate collagen synthesis. And it's a very simple intervention to add a little bit of vitamin C and gelatin. If your diet is already rich in vitamin C, you don't even really have to, we don't think, add too much vitamin C. A lot of our studies were doing it in an overnight fasted state. Vitamin C levels are low. We add the vitamin C and that gives it a beneficial effect. The reason that vitamin C is important is because when you synthesize collagen, vitamin C is an essential cofactor. If you don't have it, you can't synthesize, you can't make collagen. So then you've got a simple intervention where you're doing, you know, 15-ish grams of collagen or gelatin, hydrolyzed collagen or gelatin, and you do that an hour before your activity, and now you've given the stimulus to the cells using your activity, and you've given all of the amino acids necessary to make new collagen from your diet. Together, now you've given a really positive stimulus to increase collagen synthesis within the tissues you're trying to target.
When I first came across this work, I found it super interesting, and it's both interesting scientifically, but it's nice that it has near-term, immediate, practical application that people can use in their life. I would imagine it would be particularly helpful for those suffering from stress fractures or a variety of other ailments. And this work has returned me to the jump rope. So now I've got, I was a wrestler and we had really crude jump ropes back in the 60s and 70s, but now I've got a gee whiz jump rope.
Yeah, it's really good stuff. And because it's a relatively simple intervention, we've got a couple of case studies that we're doing. The original work was done with Greg Shaw from the Australian Institute of Sport. And because he was working at the AIS and he was working with the Brumbies rugby team, we got an opportunity to use it in return to play. So we've got a couple of rugby players who basically they ruptured their ACL. And then what we did is, once they got the fix, they went in for a surgery that was a hamstring autograft. So what that usually does is it means that it takes a long time for you to get your hamstring strength back, and it takes a long time for the graft to settle within the knee. And what we were able to do using the protocol where we do short bits of activity 3 times a day, an hour before we give them the gelatin, the rugby players were able to get their hamstring strength back within 15 weeks, which is really accelerated. They were able to get back to full rugby, international level rugby, within 30 weeks.
Wow. It's amazing.
They were getting back really quickly. And again, we've used the similar structured protocol to work with the professional basketball players. And we've got a case study coming out there where we're looking at central core tendinopathy. So it's like a little hole in the middle of your patellar tendon. And the problem there is how do you get the load into the cells that are within that little hole? Because even though there's a hole, which basically there's just water that's come into that, because when you pull on a tendon, if you've got strong collagen on the outside, it's like having one of those little Chinese finger traps where you put your fingers in and all of the strength is on the outside. So as you pull your fingers apart, what happens is it compresses and it doesn't let your fingers go. And so that's how a tendon is. When we pull on it, if there's only strong collagen on the outside, it causes compression in the middle. And that compression is a stimulus for the cells to switch from tendon cells to more like cartilage cells. And cartilage cells absorb a lot of water. And so what we did was take advantage of the viscoelastic nature of tendon. We did very slow, long isometrics. We started at 10 seconds and built up to 30 seconds. And that what it does is it allows the collagen in the outside to relax. And it relaxes enough that there's directional load put onto that center bit where the cartilage-like cells are. And when we do that, the cells get a directional stimulus, and that directional stimulus is needed for them to synthesize collagen in the right direction. And then, because we gave them the gelatin an hour before, it's got all of the building blocks to make gelatin going in that direction. And within a year, the hole had been almost completely fixed, and we've now gone out further. It's at 18 months. We had an independent orthopedic surgeon look at the MRI, and they didn't even know that there was anything wrong with the knee.
Yeah, it's amazing. You know, there are several different forms of collagen. Is there a particularly efficacious form, or you take them to function equally?
So the research here is a little bit more current. So we've got a bunch of studies right now looking at gelatin versus hydrolyzed collagen versus a jelly form, where what we've done is combined the two, gelatin and hydrolyzed collagen, to make actually a gummy. And the interesting thing there is it looks like for most people, the gelatin and the hydrolyzed collagen are fairly similar. The interesting thing is because when we made the gummy, we boiled the juice, we think that we killed the vitamin C in boiling the juice, and so we actually didn't see a positive effect from the gummy. That's easy to fix. All you have to do is you have to make it into a sour gummy, which means you take ascorbic acid crystals and you put them out and you roll your gummy into there, and now you've got your vitamin C, or you just take it with a glass of orange juice or something, and we think that that's going to be fine. But everything that we've done so far says that there's some variability between people as to whether one is better than the other, but as far as we've seen, gelatin and hydrolyzed collagen are very similar in their responsiveness. And I don't know that there's any difference between any of the products, whether the peptides. We haven't done enough work there to know whether there's any reason to go for anything that's, you know, more processed or has secondary processes done to it.
One sees not just lower body weakness and injuries in tendons, such as we're discussing with the leg, but also tendonitis kinds of injuries in shoulders and elbows. I imagine there's a variant of your protocol that suited for that as well.
Exactly. So one of the most common rupture spots for tendons is in the rotator cuff that gives you some of the basis for the shoulder rotations. And that's very, very common. Up to 80% of 80-year-olds have ruptured part of their rotator cuff. People will have a lot of experience with tendonitis in the elbow from tennis, or from you get ulnar collateral ligament issues with throwing sports. All of those things we think are going to go through a similar process. 40 minutes to an hour after you've had the nutritional supplement, all you do is you do a different exercise. And there you're doing isometric exercises for the forearm or for the elbow or for the shoulder. And there's a series of isometric exercises that a lot of physical therapists will do. They'll do a lot of internal and external rotations for the rotator cuff. All you're doing is you can do the movement, but instead of doing lots of repetitions, just do a weight that's heavy enough that it takes a good amount of effort to hold it for 10, 20, 30 seconds at the externally rotated or internally rotated point. And now that's going to load your rotator cuff. If you've got a throwing history, what You know, a lot of the pitchers will do is they'll fill a bucket with rice. You put your hand into the rice and now you're doing the rotations that you would do when you're throwing the ball. Now it's just giving you a lot more load, and that's going to target the nutrition to the tendons and ligaments that you're going to use to throw. So yes, all it is about kind of modifying what the loading program is so that you can target the nutrition to the tendons and ligaments and bones that you're most interested in targeting.
Makes sense, yeah.
This is a question submitted by friends of ours in the special ops world. One of their big issues is force absorption. You know, they take a lot of damage, both in training and in operations. And the question they had was, does a focus on eccentric training lengthen fascicles to allow for greater absorption? And how does it influence the ability to contract concentrically?
It's a good question. It's just technically very difficult because right now, I was just in Copenhagen with a guy that I would consider probably the world expert, Peter Magnusson, in looking at kind of fascicle length and eccentric loading and some of these things. He works directly with Michael Kerr. Mm. They are not really big believers in the change in fascicle length to a large degree. They do a lot of imaging using ultrasound and looking at fascicle length with different things. You'll see it to some degree with like Nordic training where you're doing eccentric hamstring work. As to whether that's going to allow better muscle control, I don't know, and whether it's about the fascicle length change. We know that if you work to do heavy either isometric or lengthening contractions, what you're going to be able to do is you're going to be able to use your muscle to absorb more force. But that's not necessarily, we don't know that that's down to fascicle length changes.
Well, that actually was a good answer to the question.
So Keith, I've heard you discuss sugar cross-linking in the context of aging and diabetes. Does this explain why diabetics suffer an increased incidence of tendon and ligament ruptures and injuries?
Yes, exactly right. And it's one of the reasons why tendon ruptures increase as we age. And there's really beautiful work by a lot of different groups that show that what are called advanced glycation end products. So these are just basically, instead of the cross-links that we were talking about earlier that are made by an enzyme in our body, these are made when sugar comes in and actually forms the same type of cross-link between collagen molecules. We're all familiar with sugar cross-linking. It's actually what we do whenever we cook. If you're going to make caramelized onions, the process of heating accelerates the formation of these advanced glycation end products. And what happens is your onions brown. If you actually take out ligaments from diabetics who haven't treated themselves well, the tendons and ligaments, the collagen is actually brown because of the same reaction that's happening. It just takes longer because the heat is obviously lower. So a lot of the secondary health problems of diabetes are down to increased cross-linking by sugar of the collagen. So there's problems within the eye where you can't see anymore because you can't see through the lens. That is caused by cross-linking of the collagens that are in the eye that makes the eye now opaque instead of being clear. The increase in cross-links in the aorta, where it's supposed to be really elastic, cause an increase in blood pressure. The increase in collagen crosslinks within the legs cause a decrease in the ability to get blood flow to the periphery. And this causes a lot of the vascular disease that you see in diabetic individuals. So a lot of what we see with aging and with diabetes and all of these types of things are increasing amounts of these kind of negative cross-linkers within tendons, ligaments of our tissues. And these things cause real problems within our body.
Hmm. Somewhat counterintuitively, coming back to tendon stiffness, in addition to fast exercise, I understand that inactivity, which is rampant in our culture, also leads to increased tendon stiffness. Can you discuss a little bit this? This is somewhat surprising at first blush.
We think it's somewhat surprising that if you're inactive, you're going to get stiffer. But what we had done to show this originally is we had actually cut the nerve to a muscle so the muscle couldn't contract. And the way that we think, again, how the crosslinks are broken within the tendon is that when your muscle contracts, you get shearing of the collagen. So if your muscle can't contract, you're not going to have this movement of the collagen molecules relative to each other. So what's going to happen is that crosslinks are going to begin to accumulate. And that's actually what we saw, is that normally we have this regional stiffness of the mechanics of the tendon, where close to the tendon, it's really stretchy. And that's the shock absorber component. But after 5 weeks of inactivity, that whole region became really, really stiff. And it's not really that weird if you think about it from a performance standpoint.
Right.
So when your favorite athlete gets injured and comes and is in a boot because they twisted their ankle or they did something, what happens is they come back. And if they try and come back a little too fast, what happens is they pull their calf muscle. And as their performance team would notice in their practice, they would actually see that they're a little bit faster. And again, that's because they're stiffer within the structure, but then they get this other pulled muscle. And that's almost always something that you see, is that you get these other pulled muscles. And that's really just that the tendon has become stiffer. And what we try and do with elite athletes is we say, okay, what we want is we want you to go fast when you're practicing. And then when you're not practicing, we want you to be completely inert, because we want you to have periods where you're not doing anything, so that, yeah, it'll maybe increase the stiffness a little bit, but it'll also allow you to fully recover and get all of those benefits as well.
Well, you've explained the apparent conundrum, and now it does make some sense. Ligament engineering is another fascinating area of your research, and you and your colleagues recently engineered the first in vitro ligaments, which I find exciting for lots of reasons. How are these ligaments created, and what insights can we gain from them, and how do you see them being used in the future?
Yeah, so the ligaments, they're really a fun tool that we have, because what we do is we take the remnants of an ACL, and we live in Davis. We're about an hour and a half, 2 hours from Lake Tahoe, which is some of the best skiing in the world. And so around this time where there's good snow up in the mountains, we get lots of ACLs coming into our hospital. And so what we'll do is we'll send students down, and they'll go collect the ACL remnant as they're getting the ACL replacement done. And what we do is we isolate the cells from these bits of tissue, and we can then grow those cells up, and then we can make ligaments out of them. And what we use is we use basically the same material that your body produces when you get a scab. So when you cut yourself and it scabs over, that material is a material called fibrin, and it's a developmental matrix that is really, your cells grow really well in it. They like it. They can use it as a nutrient source. And so what we do is we put the human ligament cells into this fibrin gel, and we put that onto a dish, and that dish contains two little bones that we make, and we make them out of brushite cement. So it's a cement that contains calcium phosphate, just like your bones. And the reason we use brushite is because it can get resorbed inside your body, and it resorbs really quite quickly compared to hydroxyapatite, which is normally what our bones have. And so what we do with them is we try and test physiology and nutrition. So we can feed something to somebody, take their blood, and use that blood to treat our ligaments for a week and see if we've increased their structural strength. Have we increased collagen synthesis? Have we done any of these things? We've used them in the past to see what kind of exercise is ideal for the tendons and ligaments. We can use them for all of these physiological purposes. I have colleagues at Michigan, Ellen Aruda and Lisa Larkin, and what they've done with them is they've actually implanted them into the knees of sheep. So what they've done is they've used human engineered ligaments that are engineered from stem cells from bone marrow of people. They make them big enough so that they can then replace the equivalent of the ACL in sheep. And when they do that, within 6 to 8 months, the ligament is actually almost as strong as the native ligament on the other knee. And so they've been looking at it more clinically as a possible way to replace ligaments after they're ruptured. And it's something that we can do. It looks really, really exciting. But the most interesting thing that they found was that when they put in human bone marrow stromal cells, so these are stem cells isolated from the bone marrow, they put that into the sheep. They came back 8, 12 months later. When they looked at the cells that were in the ligament that was now a fully strong ligament, they actually had none of the human cells left in them. They were all cells that came from the sheep. And that's really interesting, because what it says is that you don't have to make a super strong ligament. What you're trying to do is you're trying to make a ligament that's got enough material that encourages other cells to come in and populate and regenerate that tissue that you've grown. And so you can use these as a tool to understand physiology as a bioassay. You can use them as a replacement of the existing tissue when the tissue fails. So there's all kinds of really cool possibilities for these things moving forward.
It's really fascinating.
It is indeed. STEM Talk is an educational service of the Florida Institute for Human and Machine Cognition, a not-for-profit research lab pioneering groundbreaking technologies aimed at leveraging and extending human cognition, perception, locomotion, and resilience. mTOR inhibition by rapamycin is arguably the only strategy that has reliably resulted in lifespan extension across many different species. On the other hand, we know that mTORC1 activation increases muscle mass and strength, which are critical for optimizing wellness and health span into old age. In fact, a recent paper that you co-authored with Megan Roberts and a team showed that the ketogenic diet had tissue-specific effect on mTOR complex 1 signaling, decreasing signaling in the liver while increasing signaling in the muscle. Perhaps researchers should turn their attention to tissue-specific mTOR activity to further elucidate what seems on the surface like a paradox. How do we balance mTOR for longevity with the maintenance of muscle and strength quality? And if given unlimited resources, how would you design a study to explore this?
That's a great question. So one of the interesting things is that for years, people have been trying to figure out how exercise has this really vast ability to improve health in people. And as we've talked about here, when we do resistance exercise, we increase mTOR within the muscle. The interesting thing is that when we do endurance exercise or strength exercise, anything that's really changing the metabolism of the body, we don't activate mTOR in all tissues when we do the exercise. In the liver, we actually inhibit mTOR. And again, that's probably due to in the liver, a little bit more of the AMP kinase mTOR relationship. In fat, we reduce mTOR activity. In the brain, we probably increase mTOR activity. So the tissue specificity of where we're turning things on is really important. When we do a ketogenic diet, really interesting things happen. And this is specific within the animals that we studied here. What we were doing was we were looking to see whether there was a difference between the same number of calories from a mixed diet, from a low carbohydrate diet, or a ketogenic diet. And the most important and most interesting findings were that on a ketogenic diet, what we found is that it increased longevity. And these were longevity studies by a guy named John Ramsey, who's a professor here at Davis, who's probably one of the best people in the world at doing animal mouse longevity studies. And what he found is that it increased longevity about 13%. And that's really close to the amount that's improved by rapamycin in these animals. And when we looked in the liver, we saw a decrease in mTOR activity. The interesting thing that we found was if it was going to be that mTOR activity was inhibited everywhere, we would have expected maybe to see a decrease in muscle function over time. But when the animals had been on this diet for 14 months, their muscle mass was actually heavier, so they had more muscle mass than either of the other two diets, and the muscle actually was stronger and had better endurance. So this is really different than what we would have anticipated if it was that mTOR was inhibited globally. And when we looked in muscle, there was no sign that mTOR was being inhibited. Of course, we had done it in the fasted state, so we don't know what would happen in that situation with feeding. But what it does show is that there are very tissue-specific effects. In a metabolic tissue like the liver or like fat, we'd expect that a ketogenic diet might decrease the activity of this important signaling molecule, whereas in muscle, it already starts very low. And so as long as you don't inhibit the effects of feeding or activity, having low mTOR just generally isn't a bad thing. In the human studies and in the studies where they look at longevity increases due to rapamycin, they actually use a very small level of rapamycin. And it's intentionally kept small because they're trying to decrease the negative effects of rapamycin. Because long-term treatment with rapamycin can have negative effects both on muscle mass, but on also on insulin signaling and other things. And so what our research is trying to look at is we're trying to figure out whether the ketogenic diet can actually have similar effects to exercise. And there's really good evidence that it might well do that. The most important of these is my colleague Gino Cortopassi has done a large screen to see which gene families are activated the most in the ketogenic diet. And the one that comes up is the PPARs. And this is, again, important because the PPARs, together with PGC1 alpha, are what drive mitochondrial biogenesis. And that can be important because that's going to have important positive effects on muscle, especially in mice that are held in a small cage for their entire life. So the mice are held in a small cage. Their function decreases over time, largely because they're losing mitochondrial mass. When you have an increase in PPAR activity, you maintain mitochondrial mass, you maintain function. That's why the muscles of these animals had really good endurance and good strength, mm-hmm. because we had maintained the function. The other thing that was really important in the ketogenic diet study is that it increased lifespan 13%. And it's largely because in mice, 80% of mice die from cancer. So in our study, of the 10 animals that we looked at from each group, in the normal diet, 8 of them had died from cancer. In the ketogenic diet, only two of them had died from cancer. Maybe it was 3, but still you'd massively decreased the number of deaths from cancer in these animals. That's probably because you have a global inhibition of mTOR, because mTOR is important for cancer, for the growth of cancerous tumors. So whether there's something specific there about mice who die more from cancer, or whether this is just really especially important for people who have a family history of cancer, that maybe a ketogenic diet is important, that's yet to be determined. As far as experiments with this, the most interesting things that we could think of is there's 100 different possible ways of doing a ketogenic diet. It's very hard for people to stay on any diet for a long time. What we're currently looking at with John Ramsey is whether doing intermittent ketogenic diets, where you go into ketosis for a day or two, is that enough to have the positive effects? So can you do this 2 or 3 times a week and eat normally the rest of the time and still see the beneficial effects? So that's one component. The other component, which is really interesting from the ketogenic diet studies, is that like exercise, ketogenic diet improves mental functioning into old age. So one of the things that we found with our mice on a ketogenic diet is they were better able to learn and remember. They had less of the fear avoidance, and they seemed to have more of the curiosity that you would have expected from a younger animal. So there seems to be central benefits of the ketogenic diet on the brain. And the question there is that an effect of the muscle having a positive feedback to the brain, or is it a direct effect of the brain? We also know that endurance exercise, is the only stimulus that we know that increases the number of neurons we have in the brain. It also decreases neurotoxins that circulate in our body by increasing PPARs activity and increasing mitochondrial mass in the muscle. So one of the most interesting questions in this area is it that the muscle is having this really cool effect where it's doing something that is feeding back and protecting the brain and keeping the brain in better shape longer into life so that it functions better throughout life? Or is it a direct effect on the brain? And the second obvious thing is it that we're regulating in a tissue-specific manner the activity of really important things like mTOR? And so those are the things that we're really keen to look at moving forward.
We're particularly interested in some of the signaling effects of circulating ketones like beta-hydroxybutyrate. And you talked about the brain. The beta-hydroxybutyrate is a HDAC1 inhibitor, which itself is inhibitor for BDNF. And so there's, I think it was Sleeman did a really interesting paper showing that exercise elevates BDNF partially via the mechanism of beta-hydroxybutyrate going up as a consequence of the exercise and then inhibiting the inhibitor. I think we're going to run into lots and lots of these things as research proceeds.
Exactly. So one of the most interesting things that we found in the muscles of the animals that had the ketogenic diet was that you saw a huge increase in acetylated proteins. And so that's what we think is mechanistically, the line we think goes through is that the beta hydroxybutyrate is coming in, it's changing the acetylation state within the muscle and increasing acetylation. And some of the things that happen when that happens, when you increase acetylation, is it stabilizes certain proteins. And one of the proteins that becomes stabilized is P53, which is, again, it's an anti-tumor protein. Mm-hmm. And so in the Roberts paper, we showed that you get an increase in acetylated proteins within both muscle and liver, and that one of the biggest effects we saw was increasing P53. And again, that could have an anti-tumor effect as well.
Are you familiar with a class of drugs that you could characterize as PPAR delta agonists? Mm-hmm. Because, you see a lot of overlap in the effects of the ketogenic diet and this general class of drugs, sometimes called exercise mimetics.
Right. So the PPAR delta agonists, or the PPAR agonists in general, there was a lot of really strong hope for these. I know of one clinical trial that was stopped because of medical complications, because I think that the chemical activators of the PPARs are actually a little too strong and too prolonged.
Mm-hmm.
That if we're doing stuff with diet and nutrition and exercise, that that's more transient. And that the transient nature of PPAR activation is really important in making sure that we're getting positive effects from the intervention, mm-hmm. instead of getting negative effects from prolonged inhibition or prolonged activation, in this case, of the PPARs. And so you see that with a lot of things that we do with inflammation, for example. If you have long chronic inflammation, it has really bad health consequences. But one of the things that exercise does is it gives you this huge increase in inflammation, but it's acute. It's only short. And it might be that what we need is we need big interventions, or interventions that cause a big change for a short period of time in things, that over time, that if you had them continuously, they would be negative. But because you have this big increase, what your body does is it learns to respond to that, so that as, say, inflammation goes up slowly over time, it's better able to deal with those changes in inflammatory signals.
So as we're talking about longevity, few would argue that many elite athletes train for performance at the expense of health. So what would be your overall training recommendations for someone who wants to maximize health span and lifespan? And is that possible while also striving for top levels of performance?
Well, it's definitely possible to do. It's just a matter of looking at a couple of really important considerations to make. The first consideration is what's the plyometric load of what I want to do? So if the sport that you want to compete in is soccer or football or something that has a big plyometric load, and what that means is how much of a mechanical stimulus are you getting? So when you're a soccer player, you're accelerating, decelerating, you're running 5 to 10 kilometers in a game. That has a lot of impact. If you are a football player, you're obviously having impacts on every play where you're hitting somebody. So the plyometric load is really high. If you're a swimmer, you almost have no plyometric load. So that's one of the things that you have to consider. The reason that we consider it is because the plyometric load, that impact force, that happens really quickly. So if you're in a sport and you want to compete at a high level at that sport for as long as you want, what you're trying to do is, if you have a sport where there's a lot of high impact, what you're going to do is you're going to do more slow movements in the gym, because that's going to protect you from the injuries that you would normally accumulate from that high impact. If you are in a sport like swimming or rowing or cycling, where the impact of the sport is lower, you can do faster movements in the gym. And so what you're trying to do is you're trying to basically mix how much of the performance movements, the fast ones, and how much of the health movements, the slow ones, you're going to do within the gym. Mm-hmm. What you would see if you went into an NFL weight room is you would see the first and second year players, they'd all be at the Olympic weights and they'd all be lifting very quickly. The veterans who've been there 6, 7, 8, 10 years, they're all going to be over training on the machines where they can control the weight and move it slowly. So it doesn't mean that their performance is going down. The veteran's performance isn't going down. What's happening is they're fighting against a different thing. They know that their performance in their sport of interest is going to be more dependent on how healthy they are and how many practices they can make to because they're healthy, rather than being, you know, 1/100th of a second faster on a 40-yard dash,
mm-hmm.
or being able to jump an extra centimeter. So what you have as you get older as an athlete is you have to protect yourself more from the injury base. And so that means that as we age, what we're trying to get our athletes to do is do more protective movements, so they're slow movement. If you go and you lift the weight and you go to failure, that's going to give you the stimulus that you need to keep your tendons and ligaments and muscles healthy. Then what you're going to do is you're going to look at your sport. If you're in a non-impact sport like swimming or cycling, you can do some fast movements, some Olympic moves. But again, realizing that the velocity of movement is now going to increase the likelihood of an injury.
That's an excellent and thoughtful answer. When people ask me my goals for the gym, I say first, not to hurt myself.
Right. And the biggest thing is there's a really beautiful meta-analysis that looks at injury prevention. And they compare injury prevention from stretching, from heavyweight training, from, you know, intervention programs. Stretching has zero effect on injury rate. But what they found is that heavyweight training can actually decrease injury rate by about 50%.
Yeah,
and again, and the heaviness of the weight training, and why that's important, is because the heavier the weight, the slower you move it. And so what you're actually doing when you lift a heavier weight is you're actually telling your body, we're going to move it more slowly. If you go to failure, you're moving it as slow as you can. That's going to provide the beneficial effect of the gym. And really, as we become more advanced athletes, as we're becoming masters athletes, we need to go into the gym more than we did when we were younger. Because when we were younger, we could get most of the stimulus from our activity. But as we get older, now we need to have the heavy weight training as a way to protect us from the injuries that we're going to accumulate as we age.
There seems to be a belief in the world of bro science that post-exercise carbohydrate ingestion is absolutely necessary for maximizing the anabolic response to resistance training. Is this true? And if not, would you educate us as to why and what optimal nutrition around workouts should look like?
So the idea there about having high carbohydrate load after you've done your resistance exercise to maximize the anabolic response is down to that activation of mTOR. And if you remember, what we talked about is that the insulin or IGF-1 can signal to mTOR, and that together with amino acids, that's going to have a positive effect. So that's the idea behind it. And that's fine, except you've just done a workout. When you do the workout, you're activating mTOR independent of the insulin and IGF-1 signal. And so the insulin IGF-1 signal has no effect when you've already done your activity because you've lifted a weight. So now you're activating mTOR by a mechanical signal. You combine that with amino acids. The amino acids are all you need to maximally activate mTOR in that situation because you've bypassed the need for insulin by using the mechanical stimulus. So you don't, in a recovery nutrition situation, to grow muscle, we don't need carbohydrate there. And there's been a number of beautiful studies that have shown that. The only time that we would add carbohydrate into a post-exercise recovery is if we're trying to replenish glycogen quickly. So if we need to do another bout of exercise within 6 hours or within, you know, the next day we need to really be good, we're going to add carbohydrate within the first 2 hours after exercise so that we can replenish glycogen within those muscles. But if we're just looking for an anabolic response to our training, there is absolutely no need for the carbohydrate within that recovery nutrition. And it really doesn't add anything because, as I said, the mechanical stimulus has taken over for the growth factor stimulus after the exercise bout.
What do you see as the role of autophagy in the maintenance of muscle mass in aging adults?
That's really good. So we just did a recent paper in aging individuals where we noticed that autophagy is increased with age. And so autophagy, again, it's basically breakdown of protein, but it's a bigger proteins or things like mitochondria or other components of, in this case, muscle. And so the question then is, if autophagy is increasing with aging, is that a good thing or is that a bad thing? We don't know enough yet. We do see that after resistance exercise, there might be changes in autophagy, but we actually don't see really big differences between young and old in the activation of protein breakdown after a single bout of exercise. After a single bout of exercise, we definitely see changes in the protein synthetic effect. But the most interesting thing for us is that, and this paper hasn't come out yet, what we found is that in old individuals, their initial response to the exercise is the same as in young individuals. Their prolonged activation of protein synthesis is what we miss. So the response we see at 6 hours is exactly the same young and old after a single bout of exercise. But by 48 hours, the young are still high in protein synthesis, where the old, it's come back down to zero. And so we think that it's not necessarily the initial activation that we're missing, that mTOR component. But one of the things that we find is that as you get older, there's this chronic rise in the baseline level of mTOR that has feedback and it decreases insulin signaling. We become insulin resistant as we age. Mm-hmm. And one of the proteins that's important in this is a protein called the insulin receptor substrate. And what we've found, I actually had a high school student come in their summer project, was to come in and look to see what happened to insulin signaling proteins over the lifespan of an animal. And what she found beautifully was that insulin receptor substrate 1 really drops to almost zero by the time you get into your very old age. And so when you do your exercise, you can activate mTOR by the mechanical activation, but it seems like the ability to prolong the activity is dependent on the growth factor stimulation. That growth factor stimulation needs that insulin receptor substrate. Mm. And as we age, we have less and less of it. And so we don't see this prolonged activation of protein synthesis in the old animals. We think simply because they're not activating the same way after they've done a feeding now.
You know, one hears of older people essentially developing anabolic resistance, much like insulin resistance. There was a really interesting paper recently by Zhao looking at the ketogenic diet in that context and found increased IGF-1 receptor sensitivity. And I thought that was quite interesting.
Yeah. And so basically what you're seeing there is because the baseline mTOR activity is decreased throughout these tissues, because you've got this shift away from growth towards more of a metabolic concern, what happens is baseline mTOR activity goes down. When that happens, there's a feedback mechanism whereby mTOR decreases IRS or insulin signaling. Mm-hmm. And so when you decrease baseline mTOR activity, that's going to release that brake off of the insulin signaling, and it's going to return anabolic sensitivity to feeding and other stimuli.
So to what extent do you think a person's baseline body composition can impact their response to an exercise stimulus?
That's really good. So what we know is that as you increase adiposity, so increase the amount of fat that you have, that there are changes that happen within the body in response to resistance exercise. So my colleague Sue Bodine had done a beautiful study where she fed animals a high-fat diet. She then did a growth stimulus, and what she found is that the high-fat diet, in this case it was high-fat and high-carbohydrate, that diet actually blocked a lot of the ability for the muscle to grow. So the muscle only grew about half as much. So whether it's because the animals were fatter, whether it was because of the dietary intake of fat and carbohydrate together, we haven't been able to identify that yet. But what is clear is that if you have higher fat, or potentially that you have a high fat, high carbohydrate diet, you actually become less sensitive to signals to grow your muscle.
So, Keith, you have worked as a scientific advisor for a number of athletic teams and organizations, and those include the Chelsea Football Club, USA Track and Field, Paris Saint-Germain Football Club, British Cycling, the English Institute of Sport, the Leicester Tigers Rugby Team, and the Oklahoma City Thunder. In this capacity, you work to maximize the effects of training for both endurance and strength and ways to minimize injury. So what has this experience been like?
Well, it's been completely invaluable. It's something that, you know, we get into how the textbooks say things, and we get into this idea of, okay, this must be the way that it works. And then you go to people who are working at the very cutting edge, and suddenly they're telling you that, oh, actually we do this other thing. And I gave the example of British Cycling saying that they're getting stronger without their muscle mass growing. And so that leads me to actually change some of the research focus in the laboratory, because, oh, they're finding that they can do this. That goes against what we had thought. So really what we need to do is understand how they're doing this, because there might be something really important there. When you're at the cutting edge and you're trying to figure out anything that'll give you a performance benefit, what you'll do is you'll try pretty much anything. And what we learn is okay, athletes are doing this. Is there a reason for this? Is there a positive effect? And we can actually go in and discover really cool things that are coming from just, you know what, I tried this, it works, and it goes by word of mouth from athlete to athlete. Mm-hmm. If you're just in your academic situation, you're not going to hear about that. But when you go out and you're working with these teams, the teams are telling you, look, we've done this. How is it working, and how can we do it better? That's really where we have to step up and really learn how things are improving, and how we're changing physiology by doing, say, a nutritional intervention or a different loading intervention, or we're doing something else. And whether it's the military, whether it's the elite athlete, whether it's any of these groups, you learn a huge amount by listening to what they're doing. And some of it is going to turn out to be a placebo effect, or a belief effect, where individuals believe that this is really important for them, and it's going to have a positive effect. Mm-hmm. That can't be denied. But on a lot of other things, you're going to discover that they're onto something that is really changing physiology. And if we look at it, we're going to discover whole new things that are opening up different channels of physiology. And really, for me, that's been a great opportunity for me to really discover what's going on in the field with the elite athlete, or with the elite warfighter, or with any of these elite populations. That's going to tell you something huge for really trying to understand basic physiology of muscle and exercise performance.
Can certainly see why that would be the case.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm intrigued by the mission statement you have for the Functional Molecular Biology Lab. It reads, to perform world-class musculoskeletal research in a family environment. What's the story behind including a family environment in your mission statement?
When I first started setting up a lab, I really tried to understand how I wanted to structure the laboratory. And you go in a lot of places, and I hear all these stories now of other scientists who go into laboratories with lots of postdocs, and the person in charge of the lab will give the same project to two people, and he says, whichever one of you gets there first, you'll get the paper.
Oh boy.
And it really destroys trust, and it destroys the kind of environment that I think is really necessary to do really good science. Because what's going to happen is you're going to talk to somebody about your research because you're interested and excited. And if you're open, you're going to discover new things. And people are going to have ideas because they've read different things than you. They've done other things. But if you're in an environment where you're creating such competition, that's not going to happen. And so you're really going to stagnate to a large degree. And so when I was setting up my laboratory, I thought it was really important that I put down something there so that I reminded myself every day that this is the environment that I want to produce. And you know, the first people who came into my laboratory were wonderful in this situation because they were just incredible people. And throughout, you know, the years and years, it's been a wonderful experience because you get great young people. I take huge pride in the fact that they're now leading scientists, leading their own groups, coming up with discoveries that are pushing the frontiers. And I still look at them as family. I still look at them as my group and my family. So that's how I want them to view the experience. That's how I want them to experience science. I want them to be in a supportive environment that is, yeah, it's going to challenge you to be your best, but it's still going to do it. It's going to tell you jokes. It's going to do things. It's going to make sure that you're not getting too big ahead. All of those things that your family did for you, we're going to try and do those as well. And we're going to try and do it in this environment where everybody is part of the same group pulling in the same direction.
That sounds like a wonderful environment.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Keith, thank you so much for joining us today on STEM Talk. It's been a great discussion.
Thank you very much. It's been wonderful.
Thanks, Keith. We appreciate you taking the time to come on the show.
Well, thank you for the opportunity. It's a joy to be able to talk about the work that we're doing.
Very impressive.
Thank you very much.
STEM Talk.
STEM Talk.
STEM Talk.
STEM Talk.
STEM
Talk.
STEM Talk.
STEM Talk.
Well, that was fun, but after 2 hours of talking to Keith, I have to admit my head was absolutely spinning. I'm fascinated by the work that his lab is doing, and they're really doing some interesting research that's going to have potential applications down the line.
As I mentioned in part one of our interview, I have been following Keith's research for years. Keith's work on the use of gelatin to augment collagen synthesis in tendon, ligament, cartilage, and bone is quite interesting. And in the future, I certainly will be following the research his lab is doing on the ketogenic diet and its potential to increase both health span and perhaps even lifespan.
If you enjoyed this interview as much as we did, we invite you to visit the STEM Talk webpage where you can find the show notes for this and other episodes, stemtalk.us. This is Don Carnegie signing off for now.
And this is Ken Ford saying goodbye until we meet again on STEM Talk.
Thank you for listening to STEM Talk. We want this podcast to be discovered by others. So please take a minute to go to iTunes to rate the podcast and perhaps even write a review. More information about this and other episodes can be found at our website, stemtalk.us. There, you can also find more information about the guests we interview.